Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there while you're over there. Make sure you register for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Bentonville, Arkansas. That's the first weekend in May. You know you want to come to the Ozarks in the spring. It's a great time. It's a great town. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. We're going to be talking about grace and peace in Christ, only in Christ. In Christ, got that grace and peace. Not in Christ, no sir. You do not have that grace and peace. We're going to be talking about that. So there's a link in the show notes, and you can just click on that, and you can get registered, or you can go over to 1517.org. Go to the events page and scroll until you find that particular event. Get registered up. We'd love to see you there. It does sell out every year, so if you want to go, don't think about it too long. You know, just do it. Chad, we are in Esther chapter 9, going to finish Esther one way or another this episode. We've got 9 and then the shortest chapter in like all the Bible, maybe. We got a 3-verse chapter on the heels of that, so we're not going to save that for its own episode. We're going to go ahead and do both of these chapters today. We kind of ended with, Haman getting hung on his own gallows. He's out of the picture. And the Jews, of course, they still got this, you know, this decree out there because they have this horrific system in place where once a decree goes out, you can't just say, you know what, we're going to void that. I don't know if that means that, you know, it's like the Pope. Once you say it, that's the way it is. That's what it is. I don't know how just issuing another decree that is sort of opposite of that decree doesn't do the same thing by basically letting everyone know that you didn't like that first decree, but whatever. That's what they have to do. So he sends out the decree that says that, hey, these Jews are going to be able to defend themselves, so think long and hard how you want to pursue this decree. And that's kind of where we ended. Mordecai's, you know, going around. People are loving him. He's being honored. And basically has Haman's job now, and people like him. And so now we're going to see how does this shake out with the Jews and their enemies. The major enemy, Haman, he's done. But now we got another problem, sort of the final piece of this puzzle.
Yeah, Haman's been the main focus of the antagonism so far. Well, really through the whole story. But we learn in the opening verses of Esther 9 that there are also some others out there. Well, you mentioned we're done with Haman. He has a bunch of sons too, so we're going to hear about their not a happy ending in just a few minutes. But we also hear in these opening verses about those who hated the Jews. So that's the end of verse 1. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them, and then the next verse mentions those who sought their harm. And these would have been not only here in the capital of Susa, but scattered throughout all the provinces that we've talked about in earlier episodes. So whatever the source of this widespread, deep-seated antagonism was, it was out there. So Haman just happens to be the kind of the representative Jew hater, I mean, for lack of a better term, in the narrative so far. But there's a whole bunch of people out there. And evidently, when they heard about this decree, they thought, oh, great, now it's our chance to take our revenge out legally. I mean, this is like state-sponsored or at least state-okayed pogrom that was going to be against the Jews. So, yeah, like you mentioned, you can't undecree something, and so you just add another decree, and these are going to really not cancel each other out. But at least we'll give the Jews the legal means whereby to defend themselves, and in defending themselves, also to go on the offensive against those who hated them and who sought their harm. So we're going to see a lot of warfare, a lot of bloodshed, and we're going to have another exchange between Esther and the king also after the first day of fighting is over. So anyway, let's get to it. First of all, we have a long date that's set here to make sure that we understand that this is coming up on that date that was decided early on by Haman when he was casting lots, the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same. So it's finally come when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them. So this is a whole setup. On that day, when all the enemies were wanting to be victorious over the Jews, and we have this beautiful phrase. And this phrase is, in a sense, a summary statement that captures the whole essence of the story of Esther. The reverse occurred. So on this day, on this month, when this decree was go into place, when the enemies of the Jews were hoping to gain mastery over the Jews, the reverse occurred. And I think that really, I mean, that sums up everything we've been talking about, especially in the last episode about the reversal that happened with Haman. He gets hung on the very gallows that he constructed for Mordecai, the very thing, and earlier than that, the very thing that he hoped to gain for himself, to be honored by the king, he is forced to give to Mordecai as it leads him through the streets. So there's been all kinds of reversals where, when evil thought it was going to have the upper hand, it ended up being destroyed by the very thing that it had planned. So it falls into the very pit which it dug. Haman ends up being hung from the same gallows that he constructed. So here the reverse is going to occur. And the reverse is this, and this is the end of verse 1. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. So here's what's described. Verse 2. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. And then verse 3 continues this. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. Then verse 5. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed, and then we have a whole list of names here, which I won't read, Parshandatha and Dalphon and others. And these are some of the enemies of the Jews. And then verse 10 says, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of, I got to back up here. Those are the 10 sons, right?
Let's see.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yes, it is.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, okay.
You got it.
And also killed, and I won't read these names, but these are the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha. So the 10 sons of Haman also were killed. And then Haman is identified once more as the enemy of the Jews. And then at the very end of this paragraph, we have a statement that's going to come up, I think, a couple more times here, where it says, they did all of this, but what they didn't do is they didn't lay hands on any of the plunder. And we can talk about that in a minute as well. But that's what goes down on this day that was supposed to be, according to Haman's plan, for the destruction of the Jews, so that all those who hated them would be able to legally take them out. The opposite happens, and the Jews were able to stand up against these enemies and actually to gain mastery over those who had wanted to gain mastery over them.
So this is like the full reversal. Like a partial reversal or like a thwarting would be, all right, I'm telling the Jews they can defend themselves. Maybe I'm even going to give them the arms to do so. So if anyone attacks you, you feel free to take these weapons that we've supplied and any weapons that you have, you know, of yourself, and you defend yourself. That's like the plan is thwarted. The great reversal is no. The Jews go on like the offense against the people that hate them. Like they're showing up at your house now.
Yeah, this is this continues kind of in a bigger and broader scale, exactly what happened between Mordecai and Haman. Mm-hmm. So this is like you say, you have Haman, the guy who hates the Jews. You have Mordecai, the Jew. Okay, that focus of those two individuals is now kind of universalized, as it were. Now you have all the Hamanites, we might call them, and all the Mordecaites, we might say. So Haman had all these people who like him, hated the Jews, and well, they are the ones who end up being mastered instead of mastering. And then the end of that, verse 10, where it says they laid no hand on the plunder. We're not told why that is significant, but it's mentioned three times. So evidently this was something that the writer wanted to get across to us. My suspicion is that it was emphasized in order not to kind of give the impression that the Jews were just simply out to enrich themselves.
Yeah, well, it's like...
we're like Vikings going around plundering to just to gain stuff.
Yeah, this is some righteous war or some just war kind of stuff, like on a much smaller scale, right? So not showing up and fighting you because, you know, I want to take your house and your livestock and all the goods out of your storehouse. It's not anything to do with that. It has to do with the fact that you want to kill my family. And so I'm going to make sure that you can't do that. Because you also have this, you know, it's I don't know this, but this seems like they are killing men. So, like, it doesn't seem like they are going to people's houses and, like, obliterating entire households, but it says, like, they killed 500 men. Now, sometimes, of course, the Bible only counts the men, and they don't say anything about women and stuff, but I kind of read this as that's what it is. It's like, the men who hate us, we're going to remove that threat. They are actually, because they are a threat not just to our men, but to our wives and our children and this kind of stuff. And so, I think you can tell me if you read this differently, Chad, but I see it as they killed a lot of men. Doesn't seem to me that they went and killed a lot of women and children, and it also doesn't seem like they impoverished them in the sense of they didn't take all of their stuff either.
No, yeah, that's very accurate. I mean, it's pretty so a lot of the critics of Esther, of the story itself, you know, will point to this as like a kind of a wholesale slaughter. Like the Jews were just out to kill people, you know, no better than that. It's sometimes even couched in the rhetoric of what they did was no better than what Haman intended to do. Now, you can't get that from the story itself. I mean, there's limits that are indicated in the story itself. So first of all, these were men. There's no mention whatsoever of women and children being killed. And secondly, all these were their enemies. And they were the enemies who actually hated them and sought to harm them. And so you can certainly describe this as an offense on the part of the Jews, but it's only an offense that's prompted by the necessity of a defense.
Right.
So it wasn't like they just came up with this plan. Hey, you know what? There's a lot of people that would like to kill us. So let's just go out and kill them first. Now, this is entirely in response to what was begun by Haman. And, you know, like we've talked about, there was still the decree that said on such and such a day, you can take out the Jews.
Yeah.
So you've got two decrees. You got in both decrees, one side that is given the legal recourse to go on the offense or to go into the defense. And so, of course, you're going to have the necessity of the Jews taking out those who wanted to take them out instead for their very survival.
There is a saying. This is mostly a sports saying, but I think it applies to this as well. The best defense is a good offense. And what this means is that, like, sometimes, you know, you don't have to play defense if you just take them out offensively. And yeah, so you can do, what are you going to do here? You can say, well, there's a bunch of guys, at least 500, want us dead. Now, we can wait around to see if they show up at our houses or our properties, you know, one by one or five by five, or whatever, just be ready for it. Or you can just say, like, we're not willing to do that. I'm not gonna let them have, like, the element of surprise or, like, they're going to dictate where this happens. We're just going to go and eliminate this threat. That's what we're going to do. Like, this is a threat. We're going to eliminate it. We're not going to kill women. We're not going to kill children. We're not going to take their stuff. We're just defending our property, our families, and we're defending it by going and removing the threat. And so you're doing offense and defense at the same time here by saying, I don't really want you showing up at my house where my family is. I mean, that makes total sense to me. I mean, if you find out someone is planning, or 10 guys or 100 guys are planning to show up at your house, kill your whole family, you might get all your friends together and be like, I'd rather not fight that battle at my house where my family is. I mean, that's just what you would do, I would think. And so,
yeah, wise tactical decision.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I would do. I'd be like, I'm not really interested in my family being involved in this if I can get out in front of it. And so, and then you also have this that, which is interesting, like more reversal stuff. Like the governors and the officials, they're like, "What do you need? Let us help you out."
Yeah, they chose sides, right?
Yeah.
Like, listen, okay, I got this decree. On the one hand, I got this decree saying the Jew haters can kill the Jews. Okay. On the other hand, I got this decree saying the Jews can defend themselves. And it turns out the new prime minister is a Jew. Mm-hmm. And the queen is a Jew. I wonder what the best political move is going to be.
I feel like these officials were like, hey, do you guys need a list of the people that were planning on carrying this out? Because I got one.
Some spears, swords, shields, anything. Here's the key to my armory.
Yeah. They gave him a hit list and full access to the storehouses of weapons.
Yeah. Interesting here. I forgot to point this out. So back in verse 2, it says the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. I was like, that sounds like something that would be said in reference to like Egypt, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I did a quick search and turns out it does. So in Psalm 105, it says, Psalm 105:38 says, Egypt was glad when they, that is Israel, departed, for the fear of them or the dread of them had fallen upon it. So it's the idea there that, okay, you got Egypt and this dread of Israel. This prompted, of course, by the God of Israel had fallen upon the Egyptians. And so they're like happy when the Israelites leave. That's a perfect parallel to what's going on here, where you have those who sought to put the Israelites to death, kind of paralleling the Egyptians. Fear falls upon them because, of course, they realize that God is with them.
Yeah. They know this because, like, look at like how, you know, this is relatively quickly. This is like totally the power has shifted. This is the tides have turned, right? And like these guys, the people know it. The officials know it. The governors know it. Mordecai is like going through the streets, you know, being second in command of everything. They at this point, they probably know, it's probably like common knowledge that as Haman's like hanging off his gallows, that like the queen is a Jew. Yeah, I mean, the tides have turned, man. Like this is like, if you're just like in self-preservation mode, if you're just a regular person who wasn't like a Jew hater, you're like, I'm with the Jews. If you're an official, you're like, I'm with the Jews. Why? Well, because the king is married to one, and he seems to really like her, and his second in command is one, and the prime, you know, like a double plus Jew hater is hanging from gallows that are 75 foot tall. Yeah, I think it's safe to say you don't want to be on that side of this.
Yeah, they don't have to be expert politicians to realize that is the winning team from here on out.
Yeah.
So that's the first 10 verses. Then we have a conversation that takes place. So verse 11 says, that very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king then turns to Queen Esther and says, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. And he doesn't stop there. It's like he's letting her know. And then he says, basically, what do you think we should do next? What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? So what's your wish? It should be granted to you. What further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. Now, this is kind of a strange statement on the part of the king. I mean, first of all, it's hard to read the tone. It's hard to understand the tone in which he says this. I mean, is he surprised? Is he upset? Is he happy? It seems to me that he's kind of there's a bit, maybe happy is too strong a word to use, but a sense of satisfaction. Like, hey, did you hear? Took out 500 Jew haters in the citadel. What do you think we should do next? I don't know. That's a tone that I hear. It kind of almost an eagerness on his part to see what she's going to suggest should be the next step.
Well, I think that probably, of course, you know, I mean, the ego on a king like this is enormous. But still, you know, this is his wife, and he's into her, and you know, we've pointed this out throughout the entire book. Like, he comes across looking like Haman played him. And he doesn't. I'm sure he doesn't love this. Like, his wife had to reveal to him that his right hand guy was playing him like a flute, dude. And so I think part of this certainly comes across to me as him saying, "Look, I did this other decree, and yeah, your people, like, it's got everything. It's going great. So my plan worked. What do you want to do now? What should we do now?" This is a sort of is there an eagerness there for him to sort of redeem himself in the eyes of his wife, that he's not a fool, that he is not one that can be played so easily, that sort of stuff? That's what it seems to me, that he's like, what else do you want, like, for me to show you that whatever you need done, I can get done? I don't know, like, regardless how big your ego is, by what played out last episode, there's no way for you to not feel diminished. I mean, he's enraged, he's upset, I mean, he's hanging Haman from the gallows and all that stuff, but there's no way for him to not feel like, why did my wife have to uncover this?
Yeah, he hasn't, the whole story has not painted him in any kind of positive colors. I mean, throughout the entire thing, he always has to turn to other people for advice. What do you think I should do? You know, So his first wife, you know, won't come out and stroll around and show off her beauty, and he's all upset. And so his counselors have to tell him what to do. And then Haman tricks him into this. And then Esther has to reveal the plot. And, you know, even here, he's like, he doesn't make a decision. He's not like, you know, what we should do next is this. He's turning to her. So, yeah, he's a bit of a pitiful character throughout the whole story. But here he's trying to redeem himself a little bit.
Right,
yeah,
well,
get on the good side of the queen.
If your wife found out that, like, your guy was trying to kill her whole family because you said he could, you might have some, like, making up to do. Like, you might have to ask her, what do you want? What else do you want? Anything else you want? Because, like, I feel like I kind of owe you one because I kind of stepped in it here. And that's what it seems like.
Good advice for all the husbands out there. Yeah.
Like, this is a pretty big blunder in your marriage, dude, like, where you're like, I sanctioned the murder of, like, all of your relatives.
Yeah, well, I want to go out of your way to make your wife happy for a while.
Yeah.
After,
and you might be like, it was an accident. Like, I didn't know. And she'd be like, that's because you're a moron.
But instead of beginning her answer with, you moron.
She's smarter.
I do like
she's
how
smarter
she starts.
She knows this guy's still got an ego. She's smarter than that.
Yeah. So if it pleased the king, that's the way she starts out, verse 13. So, I mean, I'm just kind of going to leave this in your court. But if you're happy with this, let me suggest that let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. They're already dead. So they were killed in the day's fighting. So they're already out. They're not going to be hanged, as it were, put to executed. But their bodies will be suspended just like their dad had been. So that's her, basically her proposal is, hey, today went really well, let's do the same tomorrow.
She's not exactly over it, is she?
No, I don't think so. I think she still has she still wants to make sure the threat is eliminated entirely.
There's
only so many hours in a day for taking out your enemies, so we're gonna add another day to make sure we get even more.
This is like a two-step plan here. So first, this is how this usually goes, and something like this. It's eliminate the threat. Are you done? No. Now make an example.
Yeah. That's the second day is the making of the example there.
Yes,
for sure. Gonna hang the 10 sons on this big pole that can be seen all over the city, where Haman's body is probably still hanging. And so his 10 sons are going to be up there too. Well, the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa. 10 sons of Haman were suspended up there. And the Jews, verse 15, the Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar. And they killed 300 guys in Susa. And then we're told once more what they didn't do They laid no hands on the plunder. A lot of guys dead in Susa.
Yeah.
I mean, we got 500 here, 300 here. So a lot of dead bodies of a lot of Jew haters, those who wished them harm, those who plotted against them, those who wanted to take them out, instead are taken out themselves. So evil gets destroyed. Evil ends up falling on its own sword here. Gets destroyed by its own evil plan, which I love. I mean, we brought this up before, but it's such a great perpetual theme in the scriptures, where those who think they're going to take out God's people are taken out by their very own plans. It's a story after story. You see this, and it's a wonderful tracing of a theme that finds its ultimate fulfillment in the cross. So here you have once more this destruction of evil by evil arising in the story of Esther. So verse 16. Now, the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces. So we've just been hearing about what happened in Susa. The rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed. You ready for this, Dan?
I'm ready.
75,000 of those who hated them. But, and you could probably already guess what they didn't do, they laid no hands on the plunder. That's a big number.
It's a big number, man.
You know, this is like so many of the numbers in Scripture. You don't know what to do with them. You know, we've seen this so many times over the course of the episodes. It's obvious. I mean, the first thing I think everybody has to agree on is that it is not to be taken literally. Why? Because, do you really think? I mean, so those who would like press the literal number. So they didn't kill like 74,999. Mm-hmm. Right at, 75,000. Didn't kill 75,001. So, I mean, we can all agree that the number is rounded. The real question is, I mean, how literal is this to be taken?
Sometimes you think about, okay, like 75,000 people die. Like that's like, that happens in wars. It happens in modern wars, like with like guns and sure, when there's like the population's not the same, man. Like it's different. Like the 75,000 is a lot of people at any time. 75,000 is an insane amount of people at this time. I mean, it's so many people.
And these aren't just like Persian citizens. I mean, these are specifically, again, people who would have been plotting against the Jews. Yeah. And going on the offensive against the Jews that the Jews defend themselves against. So anyway, however you want to take the number, 75,000 is what's present here in the text.
I think you're supposed to understand that they killed a lot of people.
Yeah, that's the way that I take these numbers. There were a lot of folks out there that tried to attack the Jews, instead were attacked by the Jews and ended up losing their lives. But just like happened in the capital, so also in the provinces, they didn't take the plunder. They weren't out to just line their pockets with the stuff from the people they had killed. They were only out to defend themselves. This, so verse 17, this was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. And on the 14th day, they rested. I bet they did. They rested and made that day a day of feasting and gladness. So this is going to come up again. I mean, this is the whole story of Esther, of course, is behind the festival of Purim or Purim. And so this is going to emerge then as the etiology. This is the explanation of why you feast, why you exchange gifts, why you're glad, why you party on this particular feast. But to get there, first of all, we have to do something with the dates here. So verse 18 says the Jews who were in Susa, where Esther was and where Mordecai were, they gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th day and rested on the 15th day. And made that a day of feasting and gladness. So if you were in the capital, then you engaged in this fight on the 13th and 14th. And then on the 15th is when you had your feast and you were glad. But if you were in the provinces, then you did your battle on the 13th. And then you rested and you feasted and you had this party on the 14th. So we got two different kinds of celebrations going on here. So verse 19 says, therefore, the Jews of the villages those who lived out in the country, they hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. The reason this is important is this is going to kind of set up the verses that follow, because you got to get the feast kind of universally celebrated the same sort of way. That's going to bring up the next issue that we encounter here. So verse 20 says that Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, near and far. So when he says he recorded these things, I don't think this is not talking about writing the book of Esther, which is probably, I'm guessing, there was some short summation of the events that had transpired. So, you know, the book of Esther in brief. So here's what happened. Going to put this in this letter. Going to send it out everywhere, near and far. And Mordecai was obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday. There's that great reversal going on once more. That they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So more or less, Mordecai sends out these letters and says, hey, why don't we celebrate 2 days? Yeah. So, yeah, this has been an issue in different ways throughout the years with Christians, too. Yeah, there was a time when, well, we're still like this. I mean, when are we going to celebrate Easter, right? If you're in non-Orthodox traditions, you celebrate it one time, and then if you're in the Orthodox tradition, you celebrate another time. And so the whole celebration of different days is not just something that's restricted here to Mordecai's time. This is something that's been debated in other centuries as well. But they have kind of come up with a plan. We're going to celebrate 2 days, 14th and 15th, wherever you're at, and make sure we have a uniform calendar celebration of Purim. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. And then we have a kind of a summary statement here of the events that have transpired. Verse 24 says, for Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, P-U-R, that is cast lots, that's the Persian word, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they call these days Purim or Purim after the term Pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter and of all they had faced in this matter and of all that had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation in every clan, province, and city. That these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, never, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Basically, just a long section there that briefly recounts the reason behind the celebration and the days on which they are to celebrate it. And I mean, the reason I think probably was, first of all, to keep uniformity, and secondly, to just explain why this non-Mosaic festival is being celebrated in the first place. I mean, this is not something, of course, obviously, that Moses instituted back in the Torah, because the whole reason for it being celebrated didn't happen. But, you know, most of your celebrations, at least in the Bible themselves, are of a Mosaic origin. Right. They're in the Torah themselves. So it's a new celebration. And so they're trying to get everybody to celebrate it the same way and understand why they celebrate it as well.
Kind of a weird thing to celebrate, right? I mean, it's not, but imagine we had a day where this is the day where we killed 75,000 guys. Everyone gets a day off. And, you know, like that's, we have like sort of, you know, 4th of July, you celebrate your independence and stuff, but you get like narrowed down and get like real specific here, you know, like this is the days like where we really slaughtered a lot of people. Not where we declared our freedom or anything. So just different back then, man.
Yeah, yeah. I do love the name. So the name is ironic. So you're calling it Purim, after the lots that Haman cast to determine the day on which the slaughter was to take place. And so the lots themselves are iconic, at least originally were iconic, of the evil intent that Haman intended against the Jews. Mm-hmm. But they are, even though that has all this negativity attached to it, the Jews themselves embraced that in this ironic sort of way and said, you know what? We're actually going to call this festival where all of your evil plans were reversed after the lots that you cast to destroy us.
It's a little rub your nose in it right there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was thinking in that way, it's like the cross. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take Christians all the time. I mean, we wear crosses, we paint crosses, we have crosses all in our churches, we have Holy Cross Day. Good Friday could be called Cross Day. So we're not ashamed of the cross, even though the cross, of course, historically was a Roman instrument of execution. So what was intended to be the destruction of the Messiah, actually, we embrace that in this ironic sort of way because it is the place where our redemption took place. So a cool connection there between this festival and that other great reversal that takes place.
Well, that's where
Christ destroys death by his own death.
Yeah, that's what's awesome about Good Friday is that Good Friday is the day that, you know, where we recognize that God was put to death on this particular Friday, and we come along and say, yeah, we're going to call that Good Friday.
Yeah.
What? Like where your God was murdered? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like they could call this good Purim in the sense. Yeah. Those lots were, they were supposed to be bad. But, well, we worship a God who specializes in taking evil conceived against us and then turning that back on the very ones who intended to perpetrate the evil.
Yep.
Wrapping up this chapter, Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces, in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fast and their limiting. The command of Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So more or less, you got the twofold authority. You got the queen, and you got Mordecai, the prime minister, the grand vizier, both saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. And presumably then it was universalized and made uniform practice among the Jews way back when. Of course, it's still celebrated by Jews today. All right, now for this super, super long chapter, Esther 10. I have no idea why someone along the way in history thought that, you know what, these three verses need to be their own chapter. But here we are. I guess 10 chapters just sounds better than 9. It's a good biblical number. So anyway, Esther chapter 10, wrapping everything up. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all his acts of power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? That sounds very much like a line we would see in 1st and 2nd Kings.
Yes.
You know, how many times, you know? If you want to know more, check out the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. But this here is the Kings of Media and Persia. Four, last verse. For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers. For he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So this is, he along with Esther fall into, a significant list of Jews over the centuries, beginning with Joseph and then continuing into this intertestamental period with guys like Daniel, who were placed by God in high positions of power away from the land of Israel, precisely in order that his people might have friends in high places, basically. You know, through Joseph, he saved not only the Egyptians, but his own family. Through the work of Daniel, he brought a lot of good things to the Jews there in Babylon. And then, of course, through Esther and Mordecai, he was able to actually to save his people from the threat that was leveled against them. So God's not mentioned in the book of Esther, but he's all over the place. He's between every line because he's the one who is putting his own people in these positions of power and authority in order that he can use them to reverse the evil intended against the Jews. And so in the end, yeah, God might not be mentioned, but the whole story is impossible without him being embedded in the narrative itself.
Yeah, man. And that's it, man. We did it in 40 minutes. We were able to get through 9 and 10. That is the book of Esther. And so next week, we will be moving on to a real positive story that is very encouraging, the story of Job. We'll get into that next episode. Hey, make sure you go over and register for the regional event. It happens in May. You want to make sure to get those tickets before they sell out. There's a link in the show notes. Make sure you do that. Chad, I will see you next week for Job.
All right. See you then.